I'm Samira Ahmed, and you're listening to the BBC World Service. This is the story of how David Bowie changed our lives. I dressed Ziggy Stardust.
Ground control to Major Tom. I love that song.
Do you remember any of the other songs that you liked when you were very little?
Well, there was one which was Rebel Rebel. At one point I heard Hot Tramp. And I remember I said, Mum, what does Hot Tramp mean?
Do you remember Starman? Do you remember that song now?
Yes. Sorry, I can't help saying it like that. It wasn't just the lyrics, it was the tune. It was spellbinding.
I'll confess it now, I've been indoctrinating my children for years. That's my daughter, Lakshmi. You see, in our family, there's one man who's not just been the soundtrack to car journeys. He's been a kind of unknowing uncle, a silent hand in raising my children to think freely, independently, playfully. He is David Bowie.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good in Weird and Gilly, and the spiders from Mars.
I mean, I used to be able to stop traffic quite easily by just walking down the street, you know, no more than that, just because I had long hair. I'm a real trooper, you know. This is my life, writing or performing. It's the biggest kick I know.
But as a child, I was terrified of David Bowie, the emaciated South Londoner with the tight revealing costumes and ambiguous sexuality, especially when I thought of Major Tom, still lost in space up there somewhere, all thanks to Space Oddity. A young British Asian girl growing up in suburbia, I couldn't work out why I was so drawn to this man who disturbed me so much. I thought I was alone in my fascination. Since then, I've been finding out how wrong I was.
I'd heard that David Bowie lived just down the road, which was absolutely amazing. This is the suburbs, for heaven's sakes. And so I said, we'll go and visit him.
There was something very exciting and inspiring for the children of migrants, and no doubt for other people as well.
When I went into this room, it was just so dark, and it was so red, and it was kind of mystic.
To see an artist choosing, positively choosing, to play with identity, that's very, very attractive and inspiring.
Like me, all of these women share a British-Asian heritage. It's a heritage which includes life on the suburban fringes of the city, and for many of us, an interest in outsider figures, like David Bowie, who challenged our urge to conform, to fit in.
It is a sign of our times that a man with a painted face and carefully adjusted lipstick should inspire adoration from an audience of girls aged between 14 and 20. An ex-art student from Brixton, whose dad worked for Dr. Bernardo's Homes, has turned himself into a bizarre, self-constructed freak.
Perhaps the moment that really endeared him to so many of us was when he unleashed his most memorable incarnation, Ziggy Stardust. Fully unveiled in 1972, here was a Jaffa-haired, playfully bisexual, bizarre figure. In many ways, he really was an alien in a Britain that, to be frank, didn't really like aliens.
The government overall have put it on their shelf to bring these immigrants over here without consulting the likes of us. The British white people.
I'll tell you why I'm a member of the National Front, and you should know without asking me, and you should be a member too.
This whole area has changed completely since then, of course. It was very white working class in those days. If my mum walked across the estate, you'd hear packy, packy, that sort of thing. You know, it was still evolving.
The writer and broadcaster Sharma Pereira presented London Weekend Television's 6 o'clock show and Channel 4's Eastern Eye in the 80s. I remember watching her. She was an ex-Fleet Street reporter full of bold charm, with a wild laugh, and, most shocking for an Asian girl, dyed purple hair. But as a 70s teenager living on an inner London council estate, she'd been obsessed with David Bowie, and she didn't just consume his music, but, as we'll hear later, she went a step further, perhaps even playing a big role in the Bowie story, and one particular Bowie costume.
So we've just stepped off the Edgware Road and we're around the back of Cuthbert House, and we're looking up at the fourth floor, which is an important window, isn't it?
It's a very important window. That window, which is slightly open, is the tiny bedroom in which I did all my sort of Bowie stuff. If you were standing here in 1972, 1973, 1974, all you would be hearing is Bowie albums blaring out incredibly loudly, and my mother sort of probably screaming at me to turn it down because the neighbours will complain. That was where it all happened, you know, and all my friends would come up and we'd all squash into that little room to plan the next bit of the action, you know, where are we going to go, what are we going to do? And it was, you know, just outside that room that my mother accused me of being a street walker, because I'd gone to some theatre where Bowie and Angie were going for the evening just to see him leave, and she accused us of being women of the night.
Women of the night?
Mm, street walkers.
Everywhere there are the girls. Girls from teeny boppers to women in their early 20s.
What would it mean to you to be able to go through that door?
For Chandrika Joshi, life in Wales was a far cry from life in Uganda. Like other Asians persecuted by Idi Amin, she had come to Britain in 1972. It was her Asian upbringing that meant she saw something familiar in Britain's new glam icons.
For me, the attraction was towards Mark Bolan, the curly hair and the makeup, etc. And sort of he was a bit androgynous, and that was attractive. I was brought up with a lot of icons of different gods, and often they're androgynous in the sense that often God is considered as androgynous because he's neither male nor female, and what is neither one or the other can be both. You know, if we can look at gender and say that on the left, you know, people are very sort of masculine, and on the right, you have the feminine. Mark Bolan had crossed the midline slightly. David Bowie, to me, had crossed it a little more.
Were you frightened of him at all? Because I know I was as a young child.
You know, the kind of clothes he wore, they are so tight, so it really, you know, he's a male. And yet the face is very feminine, you know, and the short sort of hair and all the makeup, etc.
But all of this area, you see, was just very, it was just full of musicians.
So this is a stop where you'd get off for school?
Yeah.
Sharma Pereira's passion for Bowie knew no boundaries. Outside her red brick school in Maida Vale was an old phone box. At break time, whilst most of her classmates were out in the playground, this was her portal to the world of Ziggy Stardust.
About three of us would come into this phone box. Sometimes, if it was a big bean fest, there'd be others queuing up outside with the door slightly open to listen. And we'd pick up the receiver, put our money in. In those days, it was tuppence. And somebody from the press office would come on and you'd say something like, "Oh, hello, this is Joan Malone from the Daily Mirror here. I was just wondering, we need some photographs of David Bowie. Could you leave us some, please, for me to send somebody to collect later this afternoon?" And always the press office were extremely helpful, and they would say, "Yes, of course, Joan, we will leave some there for you this evening." And we would get the number 16 bus down to Park Lane, walk down to RCA in Curzon Street, and pick up those photographs, and it really was as simple as that.
In the Three Tons pub on Beckenham High Street was what became known as the Arts Lab. It was a happening of sorts, co-founded by Bowie in 1969, where anything from mime to music to puppetry could be chanced upon. High Money came from India to the UK in the 50s, when she was still known as Hyacinth Price Daniels, from a mixed Anglo-Indian background. By the time Bowie's Arts Lab was up and running, she was a budding photographer, living down the road in West Wickham. She inevitably got drawn into David Bowie's circle and had something of an epiphany.
You're a little girl, you go away to boarding school, you stay there, so you're just segregated. And then you're sent on a one-way ticket to a foreign country because your mother thinks it's a good life for you. And then you get all your certificates and you go to the labour exchange and they tell you WOGs. So I just cut myself off from the WOG situation, just fitted, slotted in. And then I go to the arts club and I see this sitar and all this stuff going on. And suddenly I'm transported, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is Asian, this is my Asian roots coming back to me. And if people like David Bowie are embracing this Asian culture, I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. Something in me is, it registered. I'd heard that David Bowie lived just down the road, which was absolutely amazing. This is the suburbs, for heaven's sakes. And so I said, we'll go and visit him. And when I went into this room, it was just so dark, and it was so red, and it was kind of mystic, and it was exotic. And there was this incense and the smells. And up until then, I had come to this country and said, I'm a child of the British Raj. And so I didn't want to think of myself as Asian. I didn't know what I was. It was so confusing. It really makes me sad.
But I'll never forget the time when my mum called me into the living room. There on the telly was Bowie being interviewed. No makeup, a polite smile. Samira, he's so intelligent, and his real name is David Jones. From then on, it was like he was welcome in our home, because underneath, it turned out, he was just like a good middle-class Asian boy.
I think I worked out what it was that for my mum was part. It was the intelligence combined with the fact that he was always, when he spoke publicly, incredibly polite and well-spoken. Very middle-class.
But he wasn't middle-class. He was, I think he was, you know, he was sort of working-class, but sort of striving.
But that's an ultimate Asian value, isn't it? Yeah. You know, self-made, in a sense self-invented, and worked hard. More and more, I look back and I can see why I identified with it.
Rupa Huck remembers gathering round the telly with her Bengali family as they judged the lineup of 80s pop stars, not on their music, but on how smart they looked.
It was a sort of listen with mother, watch with mother sort of experience, I guess. And I remember my mum, she sort of, certain ones of them she thought were what she called rocky mocky, that sort of riff-raffy type people. And they had this sort of divide of respectability and non-respectability.
And where was David Bowie by that point on that scale for your parents?
I think by the 80s, David Bowie was certainly, he'd gone respectable.
This idea that you can be thoughtful, studious, reflective, intelligent, creative, but also cool is again very inspiring for us swots for whom adult life is sometimes a great revenge.
It's a god-awful small affair. Another person who took inspiration from David Bowie was Shami Chakrabarti. As director of the Civil Liberties and Human Rights Campaign Group Liberty, she's made it her profession to challenge establishment attitudes to outsiders.
Another British Asian girl introduced me to her album collection. So now I go back from the 80s and discover the Berlin period, and in particular for me, Hunky Dory, which probably still is my favourite album of all time, actually. My favourite Beatles song is Eleanor Rigby, but Life on Mars wins hands down for me. Now that is possibly heresy, and I'll get hate mail for saying that, but I just think Life on Mars has the melancholy of Eleanor Rigby, but has those wonderful orchestral sweeps. I think the ambivalence, the complexity and the outsider otherness of Bowie has an obvious appeal to the children of migrants, and at that stage, obviously, to British Asians who are the children of migrants like you and me, I guess. For me, multiple identity and the identity that you choose, as opposed to the identity that is stamped on you by other people, is really important.
That's really interesting, because for me, the first video I really remember seeing was Boys Keep Swinging, which is 1979, and it starts out with him looking actually quite conventional. And
yes.
My mother would have watched that, thought, oh, that's David Bowie looking all right. You know, he's quite handsome, he's wearing a nice suit. And then suddenly it transforms into him dressed as these different women, this kind of glamour goddess with a long blonde wig. He's pulling off wigs and smearing the lipstick. I just find it amazing that he'd choose to do that. As an Asian girl growing up, always trying not to stand out, always trying to avoid attention because some of that attention would be racist.
I think you've really hit the nail on the head. To see an artist positively choosing to play with identity and sometimes to set themselves outside the mainstream when so many of us would have been worried about being a bit different.
By my teenage years, I could spend hours analysing David Bowie lyrics and playing the albums, but I always kept my distance. The bold one was Sharma Pereira, who took her fandom that bit further.
We got a fantastic in with a woman called Cherry Vanilla. She would tell us all sorts of things. She would tell us when he was at the theatre. She was the one who got us into the last Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders gig at Hammersmith. People stare
at the makeup on his face. Cherry Vanilla met Bowie when she was in London with the Andy Warhol troupe. When Cherry later became Bowie's publicist, she was more than happy to embrace fans like Sharma.
Because I had been a groupie myself and so passionate about music and getting close to rock stars, I treated the fans with kid gloves. I loved the fans, and I knew they were the basis of what would make this man a star.
Did he like his fans then, do you think?
Oh, they were adorable. They were just adorable. Some made dolls. In fact, I'm sorry I ever gave them away, but I had some handmade David Bowie dolls. And, of course, lots of drawings of him and paintings. And many of them came with the makeup on, and David loved that.
During the act, he slips into something new three or four times at least. David's chosen today a neat little model with a fringe. Later, he selects a satin psychedelic leotard, and then is off to the bedlam once more.
Sharma Pereira was one of those who was always sending things to David Bowie, cards, drawings of stage outfits. As we sat down in the cafe where she used to wait for a glimpse of David Bowie, she took a biro from her handbag and began scribbling, channeling a design for a costume that she sent to her idol, along with a birthday card, 40 years ago.
I have completely lost the art of drawing, so I'm just drawing this as I would have drawn it.
It's a long, lean figure with an unmistakable mullet-like hairdo.
This would have been the leg.
It's a kind of bodysuit, asymmetrical, patterned.
So you saw that this was a bare leg, and you saw that that was a patterned leg. And then I put two thin bracelets like that.
It's the shape of the leotard, bangles and all, worn by David Bowie on the Aladdin Sane tour in 1973 and at the last ever Ziggy Stardust gig. Sharma says she sent just such a design to Bowie earlier in the year and got a note back from his wife Angie, thanking her for the drawing.
So she sent me this note saying that they were trying to get it made up. And then just before he appeared at Earl's Court, my friends and I went to see him at Haddon Hall, which is where he lived at the time. And I said to him, oh, did you get my designs? And he said, oh, was it you? And I said, yes, it was. And he ruffled my hair and he said, you're in for a... Are you coming to Earl's Court next week? I said, yes. He said, oh, you're in for a surprise. Of course, I didn't quite work out what the surprise was. And even when we were there, it was actually Georgia who elbowed me in the ribs and went, that's your costume. You know, somebody had taken it and turned it into something magnificent.
Susie Ronson not only styled the Ziggy haircut, she was also his costume mistress at the time.
I worked with those costumes for a while. Well, I remember all of them very intimately. We were in Japan, I believe. David and Kensai must have been in communication. I went over to the studio with them and just picked up that costume, along with a lot of others, that big black thing that he comes out in.
I mean, one of the stories that I've been exploring in the making of this programme is that Sharma Pereira, who's a British Asian journalist, she was kind of obsessed with David Bowie as a teenager, and she sent in some designs, including one which was kind of the leotard with the one arm and the one leg.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, because David was a bit like a person that would gather in everybody's energy and gather in all the ideas. It was great because you weren't frightened to contribute, to actually open your mouth and say something. But I don't know, I never heard that anyone had given that idea in, because that was a Kansai costume, it came from Japan. Whether David had seen it and related the idea to Kansai, I don't know.
We'll probably never know whether Sharma's drawing actually inspired that costume and whether she can really claim she ever dressed Ziggy Stardust. Dates and memories can play tricks on us all. Officially, the designer's credited to the man who gave Bowie much of his look at the time, the great Japanese designer Kansai Yamamoto. Indeed, it's one of those costumes included in the Victoria and Albert Museum's forthcoming Bowie exhibition.
Not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do. Thank you. Time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth, trouble on your finger.
Of course, Ziggy Stardust wasn't going to live forever, and Sharma Pereira was there when he died, at Hammersmith Odeon on the 3rd of July 1973. The Ziggy age was over.
You're a rock and roll suicide.
It's just such sadness, isn't it? You know, you don't eat when you've lived too long. It's just...
It's bringing back something very big for you, isn't it, yeah, Sharma? You're quite emotional.
It's just lovely to hear it.
I hadn't expected, by playing Rock and Roll Suicide, to find it would bring such an instant emotional response to actually wipe away the tears.
I'm not listening to it now as Sharma aged 14, 15, 16. I'm listening to it as Sharma today, who knows so much more about life and that, you know, people do end up in bad places and whatever. And it feels like first a cry for help, but then actually a hand offered.
Sharma's right. No one can ever get back those more innocent days. But Bowie's still with us, and seems always to have been. He's been an unknowing prop for those battling through conflicted teenage years, for those raised by parents adjusting to strange shores, and to those quietly resisting a tidy life of commuter trains and conformity. Everyone loves David Bowie now, of course, but I can't help looking back longingly to those early years when David Bowie outraged adults, when he sent out his secret siren call to the children, and especially to us, British Asian girls.
It's odd how somebody's musical tastes and their environment that they created in, you could step into it and you've come home.
You know, what if we can choose who we are? And what if we can be different things at different times? And I actually think it's quite an important political message.
For me, the soul doesn't have a gender, so those are just icons who are telling us that in the way they dress, etc., to say that, look, it's okay.
If you come to my house today, you think you stepped into Rajasthan. Everything is Indian, all around Asian. It's just magnificent.
What would happen if I met David Bowie tomorrow? I've done in my head many, many times, and I think I would have a real fear if I met Bowie of spoiling something that is so important to me. And yet at the same time, of course, the other bit of me wants him to go, aren't you that girl? You're that little girl with a fluffy head that I used to, you know, you're the one who gave me that costume. That's what I'd really love to happen. At that point, there is no dream that can be broken.
But you know, in a way, the spell isn't broken because you did send in that costume, and that moment is there forever.
I know, but, I mean, what would be so sad would be to go, hello, David, and he'd go, oh, hello, nice middle-aged Asian lady, how are you?
Hot tramp, I love you so. I Dressed Ziggy Stardust was presented by me, Samira Ahmed. The producer was Alice Block, and it was a Katie Whittaker production for the BBC World Service.